After the fall of France in 1940, World War II came down to that brutal slugging match. If German U-boats could sink Britain's merchant ships faster than they could be built, the UK would be out of oil, out of coal, out of food. And the war would be won without the need for a messy invasion. Now, as a result, severe rationing coupled with constant bombing and the ever-present threat of invasion became part of life for the British. But it wasn't much fun for the U-boat crews. 70% of the submariners were killed in action. Their average life expectancy was, would you believe, just 50 days. A new book that I was telling you about earlier by Simon Parkin looks at the secret unit set up by Churchill to beat the German U-boats, and interestingly, many were won young women. The book, which I'll hold up to the microphone, is called A Game of Birds and Wolves, and I welcome Simon, its author, to our program from the BBC studios in Brighton. Simon, I've been checking on your credentials, and I find you even more interesting than your book. It's just in the book with there's a lot of emphasis on games and war games, but you come to it from a passionate interest in video games.
Hi there. Yes, that's correct. I've written about video games for the past decade or so. I'm game critic for the Observer newspaper here in the UK and often write about games for the New Yorker in America as well.
Is that what led you to the story?
Yes, partly. I was working on a radio documentary about wargaming, which I was interested in because of my interest in games and where games have in the past affected the real world. And I got to visit the Defence Academy in Shrivenham here in the UK and meet a chap called Major Tom Muat, who is essentially Her Majesty's game designer in chief. He designs and creates war games and runs them for the British military and the government. And he was the chap who first told me about this little-known unit from the Second World War.
And, of course, war games are deadly serious. Now, tell us about the U-boat threat from those new bases in France.
Yes, so after the fall of France, Germany moves its U-boat bases to a number of ports on the western coast of France. And this has the effect of extending the range, the operational reach of the U-boats so that they can now essentially travel the entire span of the Atlantic Ocean. And this has a devastating effect on merchant shipping, which Churchill described as at once the stranglehold and sole foundation of our war strategy. So as you said in the introduction, unless the U-boats could be stopped in their successful attacks on these convoys of ships, bringing the essential food and fuel to our shores, it was doubtful whether we could continue to participate in the war.
What was the scale? How many ships were actually sunk by U-boats?
Well, over the course of the war, more than almost 2,500 merchant ships were sunk, and over 100 Royal Naval ships. They were the ones that acted as sort of the protectors of the convoy that was supposed to fend off the U-boat attacks. More than 30,000 merchant sailors died in U-boat attacks. So it was an astonishing loss of both resources and life.
Simon, what was life like? Well, it was brief, as we've already pointed out, but what was life like on the U-boats themselves?
It was an incredibly challenging atmosphere and circumstance. When the U-boats left port, they were stuffed with torpedoes, which the German crews called eels. They wanted to carry as many as possible so that they could be as successful as possible in taking down merchant ships before returning to port. There was no privacy at all. It was hot, it was damp, it was sweaty.
In fact, 38 crew members on average and one toilet.
Yes, I mean, there were two bathrooms, but one would typically be just stuffed with food and tins of supplies. So yes, only one could be used.
And they must have lived in constant fear of depth charges.
Yes, that's right. So depth charges were the primary, certainly for the first part of the war, was the pr- primary way in which the naval ships would try to attack U-boats. They were essentially big barrels of oil with a explosive timer on them that was hurled over the side of a ship and timed to explode according to the depth at which the crew believed the U-boat to be. I mean, obviously, the depth charge needed to be quite close to the U-boat in order to have an effect. But yes, I think under the water it was terrifying, and U-boat crews would describe the sound of a convoy of ships going overhead as being like a train thundering if you were lying on the tracks.
So, Simon, we're talking about teenagers. We're talking about very, very young men. They would have known that their life expectancy was incredibly short. How did they deal with that?
Yes, well, the U-boat crews were treated incredibly well back at base. So as soon as they returned from this incredibly grueling ordeal at sea, they were given time off. They were given bottles of champagne for extremely low prices. Of course, all of this had been plundered from the French when the Germans invaded. So that was part of the reason that many of the young men wanted to sign up for the U-boat crews. And of course, there were three U-boat aces, who were fated really as celebrities in Germany, Kretschmer, Prien and Speck. And they were the three sort of celebrity U-boat crew captains and had endless pieces written about them and awards given. And so, yeah, this is sort of made it alluring for the U-boat men to join up to the service. They'd have rapid training, would do some exercises and then head out.
Simon, why were 1,500 condoms carried on each U-boat?
Yes, they were carried not for their traditional use, but to be inflated with helium, and then they would be raised above the ship, a bit like a balloon, I suppose, a child's party, and they were used to extend the reach of radio transmissions, and also sometimes used as weather balloons. The U-boat crews could sometimes be very useful for reporting back weather conditions to the German command so that they could better plan their bombing missions for the Blitz.
Simon, tell us about the bloke who ran U-boat ops for the Germans in 40 and 41. He'd been a submariner in World War One and was captured.
Yes, Admiral Dönitz. He believed fervently in the U-boats and believed that that was the quickest route to German victory. Prior to the war, he petitioned Admiral Raeder, who ran the German Navy, for 300 U-boats to be manufactured. And he said, with this number of U-boats, we can take out all of the merchant ships and we will win the war quickly. For one reason or another, he did not get this number of ships, of U-boats rather. But with the ones that he did get, he organized them into Wolf packs, which I'm sure will be familiar to many listeners. The idea being that it was much more effective for U-boats to work in concert, like a pack of wolves, when attacking their prey, where they could sort of bewilder and confuse the naval ships by attacking all at once, than as acting as lone wolves, essentially. And this was part of the reason why the U-boats were having such success in their attacks against the Allied ships.
Talking to Simon Parkin, author of A Game of Birds and Wolves, the secret game that won the war. Tell us about Operation Raspberry.
So on the first day of 1942, a retired naval captain called Gilbert Roberts, he was actually only 41 years old, but he'd been discharged from the Navy because he contracted tuberculosis a couple of years earlier. He was a talented tactician, and for this reason was handpicked and summoned to the Admiralty, which is the Navy's headquarters in London. There he was let into a secret. He was given the true picture of the astonishing losses in the Battle of the Atlantic, which had broadly been kept from the British people in order to maintain morale. When he is told the losses, he's obviously completely surprised. And then he's told, we want you to go to Liverpool in the north of England. And there you're going to be given a team of 10 Wrens, young women of the Royal Naval Service. We want you to get to work on this problem. Why are the U-boats being so successful in their attacks? There was a belief that the U-boats were using some sort of secret tactic that was evading the British. And they wanted Roberts, through his tactical expertise, through his expertise, expertise in war games to essentially expose this tactic, to come up with a countermeasure, a counter tactic that the Royal ships could use, and then to teach it to every naval officer who was fighting in the Battle of the Atlantic.
Now, the brilliant young women that he recruited or was given, of whom I think the youngest was only 17 years old, were part of the Women's Royal Navy Services, hence the WRENS, and they gather on the top floor of a bomb-bruised HQ in Liverpool. What do they do?
Well, the approach that Roberts and the WRENS take is rather unorthodox and also viewed with tremendous scepticism by many of their superiors. Roberts is a firm believer in the power of war games to help expose hidden tactics. And what they get to work doing is designing and running a game in which they can restage real battles that have happened in the Atlantic just a few weeks earlier on the floor of their office. And by restaging the battle and running through blow by blow what happened, from their bird's eye perspective in the game, they're able to see what the U-boats must have been doing in order for the battle to play out this way. And they have a huge success doing this when late one night, they're restaging a battle from December 1941. And they realise that there has been a cardinal misunderstanding in the British understanding of U-boat tactics. Previously, it had been believed that the U-boats must have been attacking convoys from a distance of at least 1 kilometre. This is what the manufacturers of the German torpedoes recommended. And in fact, by playing the game, they realised the only way the battle could have played out in the way that it did is if the U-boats were sneaking right into the middle of the convoy, attacking from point-blank range, and then diving to wait for all of the ships to move on. And this leads to the development of Raspberry, which you mentioned earlier. Raspberry is the countermeasure that basically says, if a U-boat is actually below us rather than a kilometre away, we're going to act in a completely different way. And Raspberry is the instruction that's given out to all of the naval ships on how to behave. It's named Raspberry by a 21-year-old Wren called Jean Laidlaw, who describes it as like blowing a raspberry at Hitler.
The voice of Simon Parkin, author of A Game of Birds and Wolves, about British efforts to destroy the U-boats during World War II, LNL on RN. And I have to remind you, you download us wherever you get your podcast or listen on the ABC Listen app. I'm interested in the way Roberts formed them into teams, one team with the U-boat captains and the other with the British Merchant Navy convoys with their military escorts. How did the war games work?
Well, it was quite a strange sight, really. Their office looked a bit like a school gymnasium crossed with a playroom, perhaps. On the floor, the linoleum floor was essentially the board in the game, which represented the sea. It was bisected with lines that at the distance between each line represented 10 nautical miles. And onto this board, there were drawn the movements of the Royal Naval ships and the movements of the U-boats. The U-boat movements were drawn in green chalk according to the moves taken by the players playing as the U-boats, and the movements of the Royal Naval ships were drawn in white chalk. Now, around the edge of the board, there were canvas sheets that looked a bit like voting booths. The Royal Naval players stood behind these booths and looked through slits in the canvas, the angle at which was designed to approximate visibility at sea. And from the information that the Royal Naval players could see, they could make out the white chalk markings, but not the green chalk markings. And they would take their moves in 2-minute intervals, saying, for example, drop a depth charge here or move at 10 knots towards this point. And the game would play out over a course of an hour or two. And at the end, everyone would come together and Roberts would go through what had happened blow by blow using a 10-foot pole, sort of like an after-match commentator. And he would explain where people had done things correctly, where they had made grave mistakes. And the game sort of took on this frisson, because for many of the players who had just been fighting in the actual Atlantic, if they lost their ship in the game, it had a sort of grave effect on them, because they would realise, had they taken those same manoeuvres out in the ocean, then they may have lost their ship there as well.
I'm astonished to learn from you that previously there'd been no proper training for the very hastily put together British crews, and they weren't taught to fight as a team at all, just as individual vessels.
Yes, that's correct. So the Royal Naval ships did undergo training in Scotland, but this was really just for how to run your individual ship as a finely tuned operation. There was no coordinated set of tactics for what to do if one of your merchant ships went up in flames and there was a U-boat in the vicinity. And what this meant was it was sort of down to the individual captains and how they responded. No one was really organising them, and there was certainly no coordinated set of tactics. After the development of the Western Approaches Tactical Unit, as Robert's unit was called, suddenly this changes, and now the Royal Naval, in fact 5,000 naval officers, went through WATU and played the game in week-long courses, and there learnt these coordinated sets of tactics, and they learnt what to do when the code word raspberry went out. There were other manoeuvres like pineapple and artichoke, and this changes everything.
Well, not every tactic discussed at WATU worked particularly well, did they? Can you explain Buttercup?
Well, Buttercup was the first attempt at having a coordinated tactic. This wasn't actually devised by Captain Roberts and the Wrens. It slightly predated them. It was designed by Captain Walker, who is a very well-known U-boat hunter in the British Navy. And it was his battle in December 1941 where he had some success against the U-boats. His escort managed to sink three U-boats. And so he believed he'd found sort of the secret tactic, and he named it Buttercup after the nickname for his wife. And actually, one of the first jobs that Roberts and the Wrens get when they're sent to Liverpool is to replay that battle, as I explained, and to see whether Buttercup truly was effective or whether it just happened to be lucky. And they expose Buttercup as actually something that came down to chance rather than design.
What are the more successful tactics deployed to beat the wolf packs?
Well, there's raspberry, which was the inaugural tactic. Then there are variations of that, half raspberry. And then they over the months, develop more and more different tactics for different circumstances, different times of the day, different weather conditions. All of these prove useful, and they're radioed out and sent out in instructions to everyone fighting in the Atlantic. But I think probably the true value that WATU brings to the Battle of the Atlantic is really forcing naval captains to think for the first time as a team, and how they can all work together. And it also added a great deal of efficiency to live combat, because now, rather than everyone having to send radio messages explaining where they're going and what they're going to do, the escort commander can essentially just radio the word raspberry across to all of the ships in his escort. Immediately they all know what to do. Everyone gets on with it.
Forgive me for being parochial, but there is a link to Australia. Tell us about Nancy Osborne.
Yes, Nancy Osborne was a brilliant young woman from Sydney. She has a very distinguished career at university, then tries to get a job on one of Sydney's leading newspapers. The editor tells her, "A woman, not on my team, never." And so she rather forlornly comes to Britain and studies at Oxbridge. And at the beginning of the war, she is picked to join the Wrens. She's one of the first women to join the Wrens. And her job is really to find brilliant young women, bring them into the Wrens and deploy them effectively. And one of her early jobs is to handpick the team of Wrens who will work at WATU and who will support Captain Roberts. And she identifies young women who have particular skills in mathematics and statistics, and even in sports and team games. So her role is very important. And also her brother, Fred Osborne, who may be familiar to some of your listeners, because he after the war returns to Australia and becomes quite a well-known politician. He works at WATU on the staff for 8 months as well, and that's where he in fact finds his wife, who is another of the Wrens working at WATU at the time.
So finally, did the strategies and tactics generated at WATU, did they defeat the U-boats or simply give Britain breathing space?
Well, I think there were numerous factors that went into the victory in the Battle of the Atlantic. Victory in the Battle of the Atlantic was, of course, absolutely essential. Had the Allies not been victorious on this front, then it's very doubtful that they would have been able to continue in the war. And Watu had a pivotal role in the victory in the Battle of the Atlantic. This is not just my view; it was also the contemporaneous view. At the end of the war, Watu and Roberts and the Wrens receive a message from Admiral Sir Max Haughton, Commander in Chief of the Western Approaches, congratulating them on their foundational work and saying that their contribution to the war effort contributed in no small measure to the final defeat of Germany. So I think it's reasonable to say that they had a hugely important role.
Every time there's an election in Australia, there's a flurry of interest in submarines, and we argue about where they'll be built, what sort of submarines they'll be, and who the hell will build them. Do you think submarines will be as important in the future as they were then?
Well, I mean, war is very different today to how it was in that time. But I mean, certainly the role that war games played in the Second World War is relevant today. And war games are used not only by militaries and navies, but also by governments. And I'm sure that the role that submarines will have currently and in the future is something that's being constantly tested in the crucible of war games. I mean, certainly here in the UK, submarines are useful. That's in the sense that that's where our nuclear weapons are kept, and the Trident, and so they still do have a role, but of course the locus of warfare has moved probably from under the water to other fronts.
A fascinating encounter, Simon, and I thank you very much for coming on the program. Simon, with his background in video games, gives us the secret game that won the war, a game of birds and wolves. And it's, who's the publisher? Oh, it's Scepter in Australia. So thank you very much for that.